The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm a producer here in the Author Events office, and tonight it is my pleasure and honor to introduce John Sayles, referred to by Roger Ebert as, quote, the conscience of American independent filmmaking. John Sayles is the writer-director of 18 movies, including Lone Star, 8 Men Out, Passion Fish, and due to the fact that it's an excellent movie and my birthright as a West Virginian, I love it more than all, Mate Juan. All right. In addition to writing more than, this is crazy, 100 screenplays, he is the author of 4 novels and 2 short story collections, including Pride of the Bimbos, Union Dues, and Dillinger in Hollywood. His work has earned 2 nominations for the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay, the Golden Globe, the National Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. His new book is called Yellow Earth, taking place at the Three Nations Reservations on the banks of the Missouri River in North Dakota, a site that echoes with the real-life reverberations of the Standing Rock protests. Yellow Earth spins a parable about Native American resistance to corporate and governmental forces. The Wall Street Journal calls this a book motored by anarchy, and that Mr. Sayles writes with such verve and colloquial humor that even the most esoteric issues brighten with fascination. Here to tell us more, ladies and gentlemen, won't you join me in welcoming John Sayles?
Thanks for coming. Yellow Earth is what I named the small city in North Dakota in the Bakken shale oil play. That's in the book. Book is kind of based on events that happened up in that part of the world from about 2007 to about 2012, 2013, and I was always kind of fascinated by this phenomenon of these kind of feeding frenzies that happen when people discover oil or gold or whatever it is that you can make money on very quickly. And so Yellow Earth is the name of the small city. The actual city that it's based on went from 15,000 people to 45,000 people within 6 months. Most of those 30,000 people who showed up being youngish men without women and their camp followers. And about half the book takes place on the Indian reservation that was right next to it, where the head of the tribal council decided this is our chance to get the federal government off our back, sovereignty by the barrel, and kind of opened his arms to the oil business and whatever it wanted to do. Unfortunately, he had a partner who was a white guy who was a con man and eventually murderer. So things didn't work out too well there either. So I'm gonna read a little, this is from the beginning of the book. This is the character who we meet. There's a lot of characters in this book and we often get a chapter or more from their point of view. And if wherever you have oil exploration and extracting, you have a lot of trucks. Trucks have to bring all the equipment in. Water, if you're fracking, you're using, you know, 1,000 times more water than the gallon of oil that's coming up. And so the highways get very, very busy. And this is a character named Buzzy who's taken off right at the beginning of the Bakken boom. And he's going to go up and work there, and he's starting out in Texas. He's looking in the rear view again. Clink Roberts, who broke him in on the rigs, always said, what's happening, what's bound to get you into trouble is always in front of you, and that's where you got to keep your head. But that was before, and now even though he's barely over the speed limit and got the road near to himself, he can't help but look behind. Buzzy swings off the bypass onto I-35 north of Dallas and eases into the passing lane. He loves to roll as long as he possibly can without shifting gears, going with the flow. And if he's going to make this run without sleep, it won't hurt to play a couple mind games to keep him on his toes. It's been a long time. When Terry packed it in and deeded him the truck, he wasn't sure at first, all that bad karma waiting at the wheel. But where else can he pull down that kind of money, they say, is just calling out his name up there. Goodbye hemorrhoids, goodbye kidney stones, goodbye huffing diesel 18 hours a day, said Harry. Terry, who is on his second wife and for some reason wants to keep her. You take this sumbitch and get up there, send me a couple grand every month till we're even. Terry had a little hotshot rig he run around Houston with, oil fields, construction, whatever. And then he got the big truck fever and borrowed enough to move on up to this Western Star 4900. And no sooner had it on the road when his butthole decided to quit the business. I'm not talking the itchy ones, just remind you they're with you a mile after now. He'll tell near strangers if they don't hold still long enough. These little bastards hurt. Doc said they could lead to complications, and that's one part of my body I don't want complicated. He tried cushions, he tried ointments, he tried twisting one way or another till his back started to spasm, but there wasn't nothing for it but to get off the road. So it's up to you, bro, he said when he showed up at the door dangling the keys. Whatever you went through before, that was none of your fault, and the thing to do is jump on back into the saddle. So he's waking up with the wolf in the northbound lane, Lisa playing lots of Reba this morning, which is fine with Buzzy, even if she is a holdover from the old man's generation. Him and Terry getting a nightly dose of Reba and Dolly and Merle and Hank Jr., while the old man emptied his toolbox, tinkering with that quagmire of a pickup truck, popping rebuild engines in and out of it like it was ever going to be more than something you'd run to the dump with. He'd crank up the radio, only part of the heap that still worked good, wrestle with the plugs and valves for a couple hours, and then slam the hood down, crank her up, and go out to put some juice back in the battery, when really it was out to Dusty's place, and the only juice he'd allow past his tonsils come from the tequila fruit. And then home in the deep dark, caterwauling the same damn song. I'd like to settle down, but they won't let me. A fugitive must be a rolling stone. When the old man was near the most settled man you'd ever want to meet, 40 years in the same house, same job, same Punch and Judy marriage, ate pork chops on Monday, goddammit, and don't put it out of order. Only good thing about boot camp, he'd always say, you knew when the fucking horn was going to blow. Whatever it was he done in Vietnam, and even Mom never heard more than the tip of it, kept him nailed down snug in West Texas the rest of his life. Tim McGraw, who the old man said he could tolerate, sings that it felt good on my lips. PLX will get you out of Texas and through a good deal of Oklahoma, where you can pick up XXY, and after that, Buzzy will go with his mixtapes. He can't deal with a CB chatter unless there's weather or some slowdown to reckon with, and those endless Louis L'Amour stories Terry used to listen to would just put him to sleep. Got to stay alert the whole way, even if alert hadn't helped any when his load started sliding. Buzzy drinks coffee, still hot out of the thermos, and powers through what's left of the Lone Star State. You got to watch your fluids, know which ones will stick and which run right through you, or you'll be stopping to tap your bladder every damn hour. Terry had one of these plastic deals, something like a vacuum cleaner hose with a little tank attached. But since he rolled alone, you still had to get your Johnson out, do your business, and tuck it back in while shifting gears and staying on the road. Pretty much the definition of unsafe at any speed. The trick is to watch your intake and develop stamina. Before the accident, Buzzy was an Iron Man, only stopped to take on fuel or change loads. If you ain't in a hurry, Clink used to say when he was racing around the oil fields, you sure as hell ain't making any bread. Welcome to the Sooner State. Buzzy is not so sure about the whole idea of Oklahoma. They taught in school how once it was Indian territory, and he figures they could have let the Indians keep it as long as they picked it up and moved it all 236 miles to the Kansas line somewhere else. That one time he tried to get a drink in the state on a Sunday, they stared at him like he had an antler growing from his forehead. And it looks like something you'd stick the poor Indians with, just flattened scrub and nothingness, like the most pitiful stretches of Texas and nothing but. They got all those tornadoes here because the wind gets so fucking bored it needs to spin in circles just to stay awake. Carrie Underwood now, who escaped from somewhere around here to get on American Idol and onto Terry's garage wall in her cowboy hat, prairie skirt, and boots, warbling her cowboy Casanova. Girl sounds like she looks, which is not always the case. Buzzy's sister Jessie sounds like a goddamn country angel when she sings, but looks like a Russian lady shot putter on steroids. The old man always moaned how he didn't get no football players for boys, and he sure didn't get any cheerleader in Jessie. Only one with brains in the family, though, got into UT and kicked butt. Sang in some outlaw chick kind of group, too, popular in the Austin clubs, covering Patsy Cline and dressing like biker sluts. She got more tattoos than Buzzy does now, which they don't seem to mind at the heart clinic she works at. In my day, the old man used to say, when she'd come home with the first bit of ink on her, pretty little tramp stamp with some oriental writing around it, a woman with a tattoo was either in the circus or peddling her ass. In your day, Jessie come back at him, which she could do like nobody else, tats only come in one color, varicose blue, and it was either mom, that anchor off of Popeye's forearm, or property of Hell's Angels. A guy in a Trans Am comes up fast from behind, and Buzzy eases over to let him go by. Nobody on my tail today, please, no matter how many times I check the damn straps. Just let me worry about what lays up ahead. It would have to be drill pipe for his first trip back. It is half the damn work available, true, but it's back there now like a loaded rifle. And if he'd been carrying still, Buzzy would be hammering his lungs with camels, one after the other. The long-haul drivers, when they talk, got their opinion of what the worst load is, with swinging beef, hazmats, and anything you got to put a tarp over always high on the list. Buzzy moved a house once, creeping extra wide down the highway with Terry blinking away behind him in his Chevy, and it near drove him crazy. Everybody and his mother-in-law piled up on your tail looking for a spot to pass, people honking. Should have hired a damn ox team to pull it. But drill pipe is the worst. Buzzy has been operating behind the dashboard since he's 14, before beer, before girls, before he had to shave, goddammit. Just head out of Floydada, what direction don't matter, and blow some air. Run down some roadkill, keep that ribbon of highway flying under your wheels. Didn't nobody in the world but Americans drive for the hell of it like that, except maybe some oil sheiks, and they do it in Beamers or solid gold caddies or some such shit. And they sure as hell don't run listening to Toby Keith singing Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue. Another damn sooner. He passes a string of extra longs hauling those wind turbine blades well over 100 foot, look like something out of a Star Wars movie, trying to put us all out of business with that wind and solar. And you gotta wish him luck. Hell, if I could just leave this rig outside for a couple days, soak up the sun, then drag a battleship halfway across the country with it, good Lord. Owner-operators be happy to say, fuck you, Mr. Texaco, and keep the difference in their pockets. And then if they could work on some kind of electromagnetic ray which would vaporize all the way stations, whew! By the time Buzzy has put the Okies in his rear view mirror, he's got his first mixtape in, which is all duets, guys and gals, Leanne and George, Trisha and Garth, Conway and Loretta, Rodney and Emmy Lou, George and Tammy, Johnny Cash and Pam Tillis, and that Alison Krauss with whoever's waiting next in the hallway. He's even got the Nancy Sinatra one about Jackson that the old man used to quote when he'd give Ma a hard time. Only Buzzy has never been to a Jackson yet worth running off to, starting with the one in Mississippi. The voices run together nice, and with so many of the women singing about what a dog their last man was, it's good to have a guy on the track to get his licks in, too. A little Volvo zips off the entrance ramp and disappears up his butt. Always wanted a bumper sticker that said, "If you can't see my mirrors, dipshit, I can't see you." Buzzy speeds up till he can spot the clueless sumbitch, then passes a couple more civilians to put some distance between them. "If you're not a hemorrhoid, get off my ass." Thing is, you really got to drive the rig. Stay with it, not sit there watching the foam poles strobe by like it's a damn video game. Sure, you can get by for hours with your mind on automatic pilot, but when a situation pops up, you'll be too slow to deal with it. He decides to stay north through Topeka and come on to KC from the west. He tears into the first of his power bars and washes it down with Nitro 2Go, which he's grown to like the taste of. Back in the day, he was a coffee and amphetamine man, jacked up to the eyeballs and then crashing between jobs, then staying on that same diet after the accident when there weren't any more jobs. Wonder he never got popped for a DUI. Blew the marriage, blew the house, got his nose rearranged a few times in bar fights, but never was on the wrong patch of road at the wrong time. Not that he'd been sensible enough to worry too much about it. It wasn't for the program and Terry staying in his corner through it all, he'd still be sitting in the loser locker feeling sorry for himself and abusing whatever substance come to hand. Buzzy's back is starting to complain, and he decides he'll hold out till the Ferris truck stop on I-29 outside of St. Joe. Good to have something to aim for. It is so easy to slip into a hole, and so damn hard to dig yourself out. The old man, he found a cozy spot about halfway down and just stayed there, while other fellas Buzzy come up with, well, there's more than a few dead or lost for good. Seems like things that used to just come natural are now actual work, like how a old rig can't make the grade anymore. Like the old man at the end laboring just to get another breath. Like how Buzzy can't remember a 10-12 hour stretch on the road seeming like such a death sentence before. Now here he is, how many wasted years later, back on the move with a load of pipe on his flatbed, like God or who is ever in charge of the whole deal saying, "Here you go, son, you get another shot at it." Sorry for the interruption. All right then, one solid year with his nose to it, maybe two if the play holds up, and he'll be back in the game for good. Sober will be tough, hell, it's tough already. But you figure that's a nice hunk of change not left on a bar counter or going up your nasal cavities. And money, real money like this promises to be, changes everything. Thank you very much, Cindy Lauper. The women, God love them, the women pretend it's not such a big thing in how they look at you. But just you stop bringing it home and see how long they stick. Get ahead a little ways, Buzzy figures, and he'll have something righteous to roll around town in. And it won't be a goddamn pickup truck. Get his teeth fixed, maybe lose a few pounds, pimp up his look a little bit. You never know what might happen. Maybe get Terry up with them, start their own field services outfit, let some other chumps do the driving and the scut work. Just gotta keep your hand on the throttle and your eye upon the rail. It's still bright enough that they haven't turned the lights on over the pumps when he pulls off the interstate. The kid fills his tanks up while Buzzy checks the cinch straps, ratcheting them to where they won't budge anymore, then tucks it in near the back of the lot, avoiding the stock haulers, and strolls into the Big Rig's family restaurant. They got George Jones coming out of the system when he walks in, low brick walls separating the table areas, lots of flowers, the real ones that come out of the ground, and it's near full, so he sits at the end of the counter. Good deal of Mexican stuff, which he doesn't trust north of San Antonio on the menu since he was last in here, and the place has a different name. Buddy orders quick, chicken fried steak, baked potato, salad with the blue cheese to give it some heft, and heads for the men's. He arranges himself on the throne, closes his eyes, and there's still road flying at him. George is piped in here too, mooning over some woman who's got the wanders. These places by the interstate never close, just change people all day and all night, like Vegas without the gambling. Sometimes long hauling in the dead hours, you pull off the highway attracted by their lights, find a couple human beings rattling around inside who'll look you in the eye. It'll near make you weep. Buzzy throws cold water on his face, mashes it dry with a pull-down paper towels, and comes out to give the room a better look. Good number of truckers, some eating together, some that look more like salesmen or customer service agents, road warriors. And then, like the name says, there's families, some traveling and some probably locals from wherever Missouri this is. The Big River is just off to the west for a lot of the trip up 29, but you don't feel it much. Buzzy takes his time eating, orders pie for dessert, decides he likes their coffee better than what comes out of the machine at his neighborhood 7-Eleven. The beast is out there waiting for him, of course, but he's hoping the tingles will shake out of his fingers before he has to go back to it. He'd forgotten that. The vibrations in Terry's rig aren't near as bad as what he's used to put up with, but it won't let him relax. The waitress is blonde and powerful-looking and friendly enough, though she's always on the move. Now, there's a job he doesn't envy. He watches her take the order from three fellas come in together without writing a thing down. And it's not that short a menu. You figure the minute a table clears out, she forgets who was sitting there, like traffic going southbound while you're going north. You'd have to be a prodigious asshole or have a seizure or something to make an impression when there's this volume of trade flowing through. Buzzy pays in cash and leaves a nice tip. That's another thing to get up there, get his credit situation straightened out. Terry has lent him his fuel man card for the next 3 months, and that should get him a toehold. Lots of situations, you walk in without plastic, and you might as well have leper printed on your T-shirt. It is night when he walks out of the restaurant, moths the size of flapjacks flittering under the lights. Buzzy checks the straps again, fires her up, and hooks into the stream of ruby taillights flowing toward the promised land. There's cloud cover and maybe rain coming and a crosswind that makes him glad he's rolling with a low profile. He's seen dry van trailers turn into sails in this kind of wind, lift the rig right off the highway. Night is different, especially with no moon or stars, just your headlights burning a tunnel in the black and you powering into it. Even when the lanes are full, you're more alone, more likely to get ambushed by your own thoughts. Buzzy tries a couple of his mixes till he settles on one Jesse give him last Christian, not that you deserve it, you sorry some bitch, and a lot of different colored people are singing about Jesus. After a bit, the words, which can sometimes put him to brooding about Ma's doomed campaign to make good Baptists out of him and Terry, kind of ease back, and it's the feeling in the voices that takes over. They sure can do that, the colored, and Buzzy feels tears running down into his stubble. Shit, he can't be that tired. He's met some truckers over the years who grease-gun their faith into every cranny of their lives, but mostly they've been guys who fucked up way worse than he ever done. Drugs you got to pump in with needles, prison time, violence, all kinds of heavy business. If Jesus really did lift them up, he pert near got a hernia doing it. But Lord, wouldn't it be nice if it were like in the songs, somebody looking out for you on the highways and byways, a great good place to go to whenever you finish your last run? There was one old boy in Lubbock named Eugene when he was promoting the gospel, though the tat on the back of his left hand told he'd been known as Pitbull when he rode with the Bandidos OMG, who did a whole rap about how he passed out after a party one night and woke up with his house afire. How Jesus had spoken to him personally, spoken softly despite the roaring flames and cracking glass, telling him which way to crawl through the blinding smoke and find the open window to safety. How that calm voice had saved him, and how he, Eugene, who had been free bracing on that night and was probably responsible for the fire, had dedicated the rest of his life to serving his Savior. And he really meant it. But if Eugene hadn't still been a scary, bullet-headed, no-neck pile of muscle, somebody like Buzzy might have asked him why Jesus, while he was at it, hadn't clued Eugene's old lady and two kids on the path out of the inferno. Slipped his mind? Wicked sense of humor? His eye was on the sparrow? Still, the singing is great. It lifts him, if that is possible, past the lights of Kansas City, on past Omaha, the traffic thinning out to a few lonely rolling islands following the thread of highway in the black night, Buzzy forgetting his own story till a hard, gut-wrenching jolt of wind pulls him back. The boys in the yard had loaded the drill pipe for him, like always. Looked fine to the eye, never a problem before. And he always made sure to check the cinch straps whenever he stopped, ratchet the slack off, and keep the load bundled tight. Only he was long hauling on a schedule and hadn't stopped yet when it happened. It was night like this, not too much moving, when the engine changed tone and he felt a little surge forward, and then sparks and flame in the mirrors as near half of the 18,000 tons of drill pipe he was carrying slid back onto the family in the VW Golf, who just drifted in behind him. He got his rig off to the side and ran back, and there was nothing to do for it but keep his back to the burning wreck and try to roll pipe off the road before anybody else crashed. He spent a night shaking in jail, and then there was people in uniforms grilling him till Terry come up to take over the rig and had a friend drive him back home. The TV at the truck stop where the friend stopped for a break showed photos of the family. Vince was the father, just home from the Gulf War. Natalie was the wife, and Melissa and Kimberly were the girls. Lawsuits like crazy, but none of them touched Buzzy. He didn't even have his license suspended. Relatives went after the service company where the real money was. The boys in the yard got fired, then hired on somewhere else within the week. The pipe got rounded up and delivered where it was meant to go. Buzzy had a hard time swallowing for a year or two. Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on, let me stand. You want to believe that it's just a thing that happened, an accident, and not part of who you are. You want to believe that nothing like that will ever happen together, again, at least not to you. But it's never going to leave. It's riding with him now, and all the dope in the world couldn't chase it away. And that cocky kid who was before the pipe come loose won't ever be again. When the mix is over, he lets the night just be for a while, no soundtrack to try to fill it up. Somehow, creeping up on Sioux City, he starts trying to do the math about how much oil you got to burn through to put in a well to drill for more oil. How many truckloads of whatever each trip burning diesel to and from, how much to drive the drill assembly a mile or two underground, how much do those gangs of pumper trucks they need for the fracturing guzzle, then all the trucks to break it down and move the pieces to the next pad, and how the whole deal rests on it. Electricity, transportation, plastic the computers are made from, heat for the dumbasses who live up in the cold places. You work around oil patch most of your life, and it seems like there's nothing but that, that it's always been and always will be. But then you figure all them cowboys that come before Henry Ford and how people still lived a full life, at least to them it seems so. And what was it, horses and grass? Squeeze a little grease out of a chunk of whale and run a lantern at night? Shit must have fallen off wagons back then, too, logs maybe, and killed people, but it wasn't so explosive. The old man did a whole demonstration for him and Terry and Jesse once, like he was the redneck science guy, on how it was only just a series of controlled explosions that moved the pistons that cranked the engine that made the machine roll forward. Boom, 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 boom. A whole damn war going on in there just to drive around the block. Whereas horses are just born to run, natural. They like it so much they'll do it with a tobacco-spitting hunk of cowboy and 50 pounds of Spanish leather piled on their backs. Not that Buzzy ever rode a horse. The night stretches on into South Dakota, and Buzzy is really feeling it, taking deep breaths and popping his eyes and starting to talk to himself some. He's never nodded off at the wheel, and he's not about to goddamn start on this trip. The energy drink don't seem to be doing much for him, so he decides to think on something raw to get that adrenaline pumping, and that always leads to Tara Beth. So maybe she took the in sickness in the health part just to mean the flu now and then, because she sure bailed quick when he needed her support. And no, things weren't 100% before the accident, but compared to most guys you can think of, he was a bargain. Didn't slip around on her. If he come home drunk, he just fell out on the couch without a fuss, paid the rent on time. But there was always some idea in her head, maybe from TV or the movies, how it was supposed to be. And to that, he could not measure up. Always had that less than expected attitude, even when he'd take her out someplace. It wasn't like she'd turn down any Millionaires or People magazine 10 sexiest men to go with him. After a short while together, they got to be, is that all there is, on her side of the bed, and this is life, darling, get used to it, on his, and never moved off their positions. He could tell that being married was important to her, to how she felt about herself and how she was around her friends. It just didn't have to be to him. And then one morning he comes home, fucked up, sure, but he never spent the whole night out before, not once. And there's half the furniture and appliances gone. Must have rented a damn U-Haul. And it's written on the back of a shopping list she never got to the store for. I mean, 5 years of marriage, use a fucking clean piece of paper. You know why, it said. Goodbye, that's all she wrote. She even took all the photographs and video of their wedding party, like erasing that any of it had ever happened. They're always talking about feelings, woman, but you got to have ESP or something to pick up on their moods. And when it comes down to the crunch, they can cut you dead without a twinge of emotion. Let your guard down, show a little weakness, and they're gone with the wind. Buzzy grabs one of his mixes at random and jams it into the slot, cranking the volume up as loud as he can stand. But it's just noise, because the only song he wants to hear, the only true one, is another from the old man's era, Johnny Paycheck, before he shot that fella and made his trip up the river. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. My woman left home and took all the things I've been working for. Buzzy grinds through to daybreak, crosses the ND line and cuts west on I-94. And suddenly he's got company. More flatbeds hauling casing. Three low boys carrying thumper trucks with their extra wide tires, 30-ton winch trucks, tankers, a convoy with various pieces of drill rig dealt out between them, little knuckle boom cranes and their big brothers, coil tubing trucks, fracking pump trucks with their huge rusty muffler units mounted on top, and Kenworths and Peterbilts and Freightliners and old beat-up Macs. And by the time they're all take the U.S. 83 exit at Bismarck, it's a goddamn army on the move. Buzzy getting his third wind from all the energy of it around him till they slow to a crawl on the four lane, and he realizes he's already late to the party. Just look at all these people. 20 miles short of the Three Nations res, he sees a new painted sign for Gill's Park and Snooze by the side of the road. But it looks to be only some open space in a field behind a row of storage containers with cots lined up in them. Be sleeping in the rig for a spell. Buzzy cranks his window down and calls across to the white-bearded character driving the drop-deck semi in the next lane. Hey, buddy, it always like this? This time of day? Sure, you knew? Started up from Houston yesterday morning. The old man lifts his drill baby drill cap in salute. Sonny? He smiles. Welcome to the Wild West.
Thanks.
So if you got any questions, somebody will be in the aisles with microphones and just raise your hand and I'll call on you and you can stand up and they'll get you a microphone.
So which comes first for you, the picture or the word?
The picture's the word, you know, they kind of come together. Even when I write screenplays, I will usually do a version just for myself that has no dialogue in it. And that makes you think in camera movement and pictures. I think really first comes the situation and the characters, and then they start, you start thinking about the characters and how they would speak. you know, where they're coming from, if and when and where they got educated, you know, the rhythm that they would be speaking in. You know, I've got a couple chapters that are set right on the oil rig, where often is heard a discouraging word. And then, you know, there's a scene in a high school classroom where the teacher's not going to talk like that. So yeah, they do kind of come together.
Hi, jumping back a bit in time in your career, one of my favorite movies has always been The Secret of Rowan Inish.
Oh, thanks.
So, yeah, that's great. I was just wondering if you have any recollections about making it or the decision to, you know, to pick that book to make a film from or anything like that. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I got the idea for it. Maggie Renzi, who I live with and who's produced a bunch of my movies, including that one, read that book when she was about 10 years old. It was a book called The Secret of Ron Moore Scary, by a woman named Rosalie K. Fry, who was also a really nice, simple illustrator. I always loved, when I was a kid, books that had, you know, N.C. Wyeth or somebody, you know, had done the illustrations for them. And she had been, she was living up on the coast of Scotland and during World War II, and they enlisted her to be a coast watcher, to like sit with binoculars and look for German submarines. And she didn't see any German submarines, but she saw a lot of seals. And then she asked the local people, are there any stories, like, you know, tales about these seals? And they started telling her the various Selkie myths. And then when I made the movie, I was more familiar with Irish culture and literature than I was with Scots, and they have the same seals there and most of the same stories. So I set it there. And it was really a lot of fun. The little girl who was in it was just a great kid. Everybody looked forward to her coming to the set. And we got to work with three seals who were not trained but were habituated to be around people that had been orphans who they had saved. And mostly we just figured out how to catch their natural behaviors. Early in the movie, there's a scene that where I had described an over-the-shoulder shot. And seals don't have shoulders. But it was behind the seal. And to get a seal to look at something is easy, but on the second take, it's not going to look at it again. So we had to keep inventing new ways, noises, beach balls, umbrellas, to get the seal to actually look left or right. So it was a lot of fun.
For the part of your book that you just read, you seem to possess a detailed knowledge of over-the-road trucking. Have you ever done it? Do you sit down and interview truckers before you do it? Do you make that run? Did you ever drive from Houston to North Dakota? How do you get so much into the brain of a guy?
Actually, that I used to hitchhike in the late 60s and early 70s, and one of the first long rides I got must have been in the late 60s because the CB radio hadn't really hit yet. Was by a guy who said, "Boy, buddy, I'm glad to have you here. I'm just shaking apart here." And he told me that story about this was the first time back behind the wheel after people had gotten killed by drill pipe that was on his trailer. So that I always kind of remembered that. And my first short story that I ever got published in a magazine was a story called I-80 Nebraska, which is kind of about a Flying Dutchman trucker who just keeps going northbound and then southbound, and he's all over the CB radio freaking people out. So I did quite a bit of research for that. I've probably ridden across the country and back if you put all the rides that I had with truck drivers. And, you know, if you're hitchhiking, your function is either to be entertainment or an audience. And so about half the time I was an audience, and so you hear a lot from people. It's changed quite a bit. The biggest change after the CB radios was a lot more of the owner-operators go out with their wives, who also get a trucker's license, and one is sleeping in the little ledge behind the driver while the other one is driving, which means that they can keep rolling for longer without worrying about somebody falling asleep at the wheel or having to stop when you don't need to stop for gas or whatever. And it's probably a lot better for their marriages.
Hi, thank you for being here. I'm an aspiring writer. I'm sure if you have any advice, I mean, like keep writing or you got some significant, you're extraordinarily talented, but you get some significant breaks. I don't know if you have any ideas, let's say getting agents or just there's no way I could get that level of detail that you have that you can see it all happening. I'm not that good, but I mean, if you have any advice when you sort of might get,
know, I was one of those lucky people who back when magazines, many magazines actually took unsolicited manuscripts. So when I started out, I came in over the transom, as they say, and got that story I was just talking about accepted at the Atlantic Magazine. I did not have an agent until my second book, and then some guy who said he was a literary agent played poker with some friends, and they said, "Well, oh, you know John Sayles?" And they said, "Yeah." And they said, "Don't call him." And so he called me, and he sold my second book because I was working in summer stock theater, and I didn't have time to go try to peddle my own book myself. So I met him. He later became like a major editor and stuff like that. And he had a very deep voice, and he looked like he was about 15 years old. When I met him, it was like, you know, who's this kid, you know, pretending to be a literary agent? It helps to have a literary agent, sort of. I mean, my last novel took 2 years to find a publisher. This one took a year to find a publisher. So it's not easy, even if you have a track record of some sort. As for the writing, you know, what I recommend is as you're learning, as you're trying stuff, just take a section, you know, take a 10 page section. It doesn't have to be a whole chapter. And there's three characters in it. Rewrite it from each of those different characters' point of view. What would they see in that scene? If it's in present tense, put it in past tense. If it's in past tense, put it in present tense. Write it without any dialogue, you know, write it with only dialogue, you know, and you start to see what, not only, you know, kind of build your muscles doing those things, but you also start to see, oh, for this particular story, this is great from that, you know, and maybe I love two of these. So maybe I'm going to have one, maybe I can tell the same chapter, the same action over, but different people have seen it. And the audience, you know, the reader gets that kind of, you know, feeling like, oh, this is a totally different scene. You know, maybe that first guy was lying to me, or, you know, he's clueless as to what's happening. So I think just playing around with it, really you learn how to write by writing. You learn a lot from reading. And I was always a really conscious reader. I think I was probably 10 years old, or about 10, when I read a book called The Black Stallion, which was later made into a movie. James Farley, I think, was the author. And through the whole book, it's kind of omniscient, but you're mostly staying close to this kid. You know, it's a boy's adventure story, and he kind of bonds with this wild stallion and tames him and learns to ride him, and they get brought back to civilization, and people are just amazed at how fast this thing is. And some promoter gets wind of this and decides, I'm going to do a stunt, and I'm going to have this stallion who's never raced in around a track before, I'm going to have him race against the two premier thoroughbreds of the day. And everybody's wanted to see the two of them go head-to-head, but I'm going to put this third horse in there just for the, you know, the novelty value of it. So you get to the last chapter, and all of a sudden, the author, James Farley, he just totally changes the point of view of the book to that of an 80-year-old race handicapper. And the first line of the chapter is something like, he had always wanted to handicap a triple heat. And at first, as a reader, as a 10-year-old, it's like, whoa, where's this going? Why am I hanging out with this old guy? And then he describes the race from the handicapper's point of view. And because you're invested emotionally in the horse and the kid who's riding him, you're still there emotionally. But there's a little bit of distance that's really interesting. And the last line of the book is something like, he should have put another 16th of a pound on the stallion. And you realize he won by that much. So, you know, that started me being really, you know, there in the book of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, late in the book, you're in the Chief Bromden's POV, and in the middle of a sentence, you change from past tense to present tense. You know, and at first I thought it was a typo, and then I realized, no, the rest of the book is in present tense. He just came out of his, you know, Thorazine fog, and he's with us now.
Well, first, thank you for spoiling the Black Stallion for me.
Yeah. There may be a sequel where he doesn't win.
Just wondering about, I don't know how you cobbled the money together to make your early films, and the life of an independent filmmaker at the time must be very different than what it is now with the streaming platforms and and the bundles of money that are out there. How would your career be different? Have you ever thought, you know, like if you had had all these platforms to choose from, what might be different?
You know, I think we got really lucky when I started trying to make movies. I made a certain amount of money as a screenwriter writing creature features for Roger Corman. I wrote things like Piranha and The Howling and Alligator. And although I was getting minimum, he was a signatory to the Writers Guild then, so I was getting $10,000 a screenplay, which compared to what you make as a novelist, or certainly what I made as a novelist, was an enormous amount of money. So I was able to make my own first movie with my own money and be an investor in my second movie and an investor in my third movie. And then home video showed up, which had not been a factor before, and there was money from that available. Pretty much right now, it's a lot harder to get anybody else's money. And if you're going to work with professionals, it's more expensive to make a movie. So it's actually harder for me to get a movie made than it was back in the 80s. You know, it's easier to have it out there in some way. But the web has not monetized, as they say. So when you're streaming something, it's pretty unlikely that the filmmaker is getting any money, especially if you watch something on YouTube. We regularly have the woman who runs our office go through YouTube and ask them to take things down that somebody just pointed their camera at the TV station or whatever that was running it, who might have paid something for. It is harder also because when I go and talk to producers now, I am much older than all of them, and they're the producers, and they say things like, oh yeah, we had to watch one of your movies in film school. They liked it, usually, or they say it.
So, I see you're on Haymarket now, which I love. How's working with them?
They've been great so far. You know, they don't publish that much fiction, but they do publish some fiction. And they work hard. Literary agent, we tried getting this published somewhere else for about a year, and nobody was interested. And he said, well, I'm on the board of Haymarket, and we'd love to do it, but I will have to recuse myself and not take my agent's 10%. And I said, well, since you're not paying me in advance, you're not losing a whole lot of money, are you? But they've been great. And, you know, and I've read stuff of theirs before and, you know, always interested in what's in their catalog. So it's, you know, and they made a really nice book jacket. The cover's really nice.
Did you do any special research for the Native American parts of the book?
Yeah, I had certainly, you know, having written over 100 screenplays, some of them are, you know, some of them are set on, you know, during the French and Indian War, or I wrote one that was, you know, based on Jim Thorpe when he played against Army in 1912 after he'd won the Olympics. You know, I've gone there before with research. We were trying to make, to raise the money for a screenplay that I've written called To Save the Man, that's about Colonel Pratt, who started the Carlisle Indian School, and kids going there, set in 1890, which was kind of a important year there because it was also the year of the massacre at Wounded Knee. And there were a lot of Sioux kids there. And the news was about a day behind events when it got to the Carlisle School. Famously, a Carlisle graduate had left the school, I think about 4 months earlier, before Wounded Knee. And he hadn't done very well there. They mostly sent him out farming, and you know, when he came back, his Lakota was not very good. He lost some of his ability in his own native language because you weren't allowed to speak it while you were at the school, and people were just calling him, you know, an apple, you know, red on the outside, white on the inside. He was not doing well there, and he was not in the line of fire during the Wounded Knee massacre, but the day after all those people were killed, he walked up behind a U.S. Army lieutenant who was doing a parlay with some of the other Sioux and blew his brains out with a gun, thinking, okay, they're going to hang me. I'll be a martyr, but I'll be a warrior. And those pictures that you've seen of Wounded Knee, the press who had pretty much precipitated that massacre by all their horror stories about the ghost dance and stuff like that. Well, they were happy to also propagate, oh, people will buy, you know, pictures of dead Indians frozen on the ground. And so they sent those around. And the public reaction was so clearly an overreaction by the Army that there was this hue and cry for an investigation. And so what the Army, they had this young guy in the stockade who they were going to hang, and they said, oh, that's going to be bad, that's going to be really bad. So they declared it a war and that he was a combatant, and they let him go. While we were trying to raise money for that picture, I got to spend a lot of time in Indian country and got to meet some Native American lawyers and learn a lot about, you know, the intricacies of, you know, Indian law and how it's still incredible struggle to not just get screwed. Meet some, you know, people who were around this situation. This is based on a reservation that's like one reservation north of Standing Rock. And so they were right in the thick of the whole, you know, fracking thing and the aftermath of that.
Hi, do you have stories or encounters with people in flyover red state America seeing or reading your work and their reaction to your work? I feel like there's a huge amount of people in cities who might have seen, say, men with guns. And I wonder if someone in say, Texas or you know, people in the oil patch reading your book.
It's amazing, how the question before about streaming and everything like that. It used to be that there were a very limited number of movie theaters that showed non-Hollywood movies. I won't say art movies because some of them are just non-Hollywood. They may be, you know, Pulp Fiction-y kind of movies from Korea or something, but they wouldn't show in a mainstream film until very recently. And the same thing with books. You just, you know, books hang around and they get into libraries and people pick them up. So I run into people all over the country. We made a movie in West Virginia that, you know, you can probably find in hardware stores in West Virginia. We made a movie on the Texas border that is, you know, really well known in Texas. We made a movie in Florida that's really well known in Florida, that got into the, you know, like the travel guide. If you're going to Florida, read this, you know, look at this movie and read this book, Los Casanos. I mean, you never know if people are going to like it anywhere, you know, but when people give things a chance, they're kind of interested in it. And certainly I've spent at least a night in every state in the Union and, you know, spent a lot of time in the West, traveling across the country. My last book, we drove 40 days and 40 nights, went across the country, went up the West Coast, came down the West Coast, drove back. And you get a very particular view of America if you only go to independent bookstores. But you do meet people who, you know, they came because they saw Eight Men Out, you know, and they love baseball or whatever. And then they said, well, and they tried some of your other movies, and some of those were pretty cool. So, you know, I think it was John Cheever who, you know, said he lived up in Connecticut or something, somewhere in New England, and he looked out the back of window where the chair that he wrote in, and there were woods there. And he said, I always think of my audience, my readers, as being behind those trees.
Do you have any personal favorites from your prodigious body of work?
You know, I think my last novel, A Moment in the Sun, is my favorite thing that I've written. I felt like I was kind of hitting on all cylinders on that one. It is over 1,000 pages long, so which tends to, you know, it's one of the reasons it took 2 years to find a publisher, I'm sure. They mostly weighed it and said, you can imagine what that looked like in double spaced. You know, it was like three or four notebooks full of prose. And with my movies, it's more the experiences of making the movie rather than the movie itself. That, you know, some of them are, you know, making Mate One in West Virginia was special. We got to make a movie in Juneau, Alaska. The only time I've had to say cut because there was a whale spouting in the background and upstaging my actors. So yeah, it's more, you know, your memories of making it, the experiences that kind of stay with me. And some are just hard. You know, some are just, it's just really work, and the place is kind of unforgiving, but that's where the movie has to take place. I just wrote a movie that I wrote, Sonora, directed by Alejandro Springle, is just out streamable on a platform called Pantaya in the United States. And it's a Mexican movie set in the 30s. It's kind of like John Ford's Stagecoach, but when the Depression happened, President Hoover closed the southern border to foreigners coming across. We deported a whole lot of people back to Mexico, including people who were born in the United States and didn't have birth certificates, who were dumped on the other side of the line. And because of that, Mexican people who used to go up to Tucson and then go on our highways and then go down through Tijuana into Baja, which was a territory then, they had to actually cross the Sonoran Desert, and there were taxi services that did it despite the fact that there wasn't a road. And so it's a movie about a diverse group of people who are in the same Packard crossing the Sonora Desert. And that's, you know, that's one of my favorite movies that I didn't even make, you know. And I was really very aware while I was writing it and saying, and it's really hot and they have no water and there are blisters on, I'm not going to have to go and shoot this. So keep that in mind. Thanks so much for coming, everybody. And I'll be upstairs.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.